The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week, we choose three pieces from the magazine and ask their writers to read them aloud. I'm Oscar Edmondson, and on the podcast this week, Sophie Winkleman reads her actress's notebook on why she's fighting to ban smartphones for children. Svetlana Monets details how Ukraine plans to revive its birth rate. Candida Crew discusses the horror of UHT milk. And Ascendant Maxtone Graham writes about the sad disbanding of the Cambridge student choir St John's Voices. Up first, Sophie Winkleman.
I'm not often lost for words, but the five middle-aged homeless men who spoke at the Big Issue celebration in the House of Lords last month left me truly awestruck. All five had endured lives of childhood abandonment, violence, pain, destitution. All five had emerged from the darkness, philosophical, hopeful, and loving of their fellow man. I have not stopped thinking about them. And when I start on my usual daily beefs, signs on the tube telling me I mustn't give money to beggars, why not if I want to? Signs on the tube telling me I can't stare at people, well, what if someone is listening to a deafening, violent video on their phone? Should I deck them instead? Signs on the tube telling me I mustn't press into someone. Try the Victoria line at 6 p.m, you TFL halfwits. I think of these brave, strong men, and I breathe in deeply. I'm seeing these daft tube signs rather a lot lately. My life is now hopping on the district line to Westminster for a daily fight to ban smartphones and social media for under-16s, along with a gang of cross-party MPs, writers, teachers and doctors. The facts are so bleak. The failing eyesight, the wrecked concentration spans, antisocial behaviour, insomnia, depression, self-harm, anorexia, porn and gaming addictions and worse. The teens I've met across the country in my role as patron of an education charity are desperate for the damn things to be taken away. Many libertarians think the onus should be on parents to ban smartphones, not the government. That's fair enough in principle, impossible in practice. Every atom of a teen's life is online. Travel card, bank card, social life, even homework. These machines are designed by geniuses to be more addictive than heroin. It's not possible to put them down. Sure, middle-class parents can beg their teens to put their phone away each night. But what about our poorer children whose parents can't always supervise them? They're the ones whose life chances are being destroyed by the compulsive, pointless, damaging junk on smartphones, and they must be protected. The online safety bill won't go nearly far enough. It may remove some harmful content, but it won't touch the sides of the unputdownable, isolating, focus-wrecking nature of these phones. Another major factor in the degradation of children's minds is the shift to digital education. This should have been an emergency move during lockdown and then straight back to books, paper and pens. Most intelligent countries are chucking tech out of the classroom as overall progress and IQ levels glide downwards like dying birds. Here in Britain, far more scepticism should be applied to these shiny platforms, which serve only to stoke screen addiction, further damage eyesight, and encourage shallow, short-form thinking. It was lovely to bump into a fellow fighter in the anti-screens movement yesterday. Daisy Greenwell and I walked straight into each other on Quay Street in Orford, Suffolk, where I've come to visit my parents for Easter. Fortunately, our children were all walking the no-tech walk, mine up a tree, hers sandy, tousled and clutching buckets and spades. We embraced as old friends, though we've never met before. I've joined her and Claire Ferniehuff's triumphant movement, Parents for a Smartphone-Free Childhood, and she's read some of my scribblings, an instant bond founded on a common goal and a shared God in the form of Jonathan Haidt, psychologist and author of our Bible, The Anxious Generation. Perhaps the most frustrating refrain we hear in this fight is "the genie's out of the bottle." Such defeatism confounds us. We're talking about mass social, educational, cognitive and developmental harm. In other words, mass brain damage. We have the bottle. We must cram the genie back in. Out here in somnolently peaceful, pure-aired Orford, I feel I can breathe. The glorious 14th century church, the fairy tale castle built by Henry II, the village shop with its locally made pork pies and fairy cakes, the allotments chirruping with chiff-chaffs, tits and finches, banks of nodding daffodils and endless vistas of flat, dreamy waterscapes. It all fills me with love for England. While I like meeting strangers every day in London, the sight of village regulars I've known for 30 years is calming to the spirit. From Guy, the churchwarden who takes my girls up to the bell tower, to Adrian the fisherman who delivers me a dozy lobster every time I'm in the village, to Laura who can carry 2 20-kilogram sacks of salt as if they're babies, and Sue who always saves me a box of those fairy cakes, it's a blessed respite from the bustling solipsism of the Big Smoke. Right, off to visit the Palm Sunday donkey now. Happy Easter, everyone.
That was Sophie Winkleman. Next, Svetlana Monyets.
In my village in Ukraine, there aren't many families left intact. The funerals of those who have been killed in the war have been taking place with crushing regularity. It feels like everyone's loss. Today, in house after house, you can find parents whose children have either died or are still fighting, with no indication of when they may return. It's almost impossible for couples to start families. Men are deployed to the front line with little hope of any leave. If they return alive, most are maimed in some way. There is, though, a spark of hope for these young Ukrainians. Ukraine has quite an advanced network of fertility clinics, which are often used in more peaceful times by foreigners, taking advantage of liberal surrogacy laws. Soldiers heading to the front have begun to visit these clinics to freeze their sperm and make a biological will, naming the woman who would have the right to use it for IVF during their deployment or even in a postmortem conception. There are a few female soldiers too who have done the same with their eggs. A few months ago, rules were about to be changed to order the destruction of soldiers' sperm in the event of their death. But following a backlash from soldiers' partners as well as medical professionals, a new law was passed, which says that any soldier wishing to have their gametes frozen will have storage costs paid for by the state as of next year and for 3 years after their death. Successful IVF treatment has existed since 1977, when Louise Brown was conceived in the UK, but postmortem IVF has triggered ethical debates for a long time. It is obviously ethically complicated to create a child who will not have a father. Critics in Israel refer to it as planned orphanhood. And it is illegal in Italy, Germany, and Sweden. That bereavement should be closely followed by pregnancy and single parenthood inevitably piles on emotional and financial pressures for the mother. For this reason, the US makes widows wait a year before going ahead with the creation of an embryo. In Ukraine, the birth rate, just 187,000 last year, is a third of what it was before the full-scale invasion, while there were half as many IVF births last year, 6,000 as previously. The crisis has swept aside any misgivings. It's up to would-be parents to decide whether they want to take this step. War takes life in many ways. At least 31,000 have fallen in battle and 10,000 civilians have been killed by Russian attacks, with 20,000 children kidnapped and deported to Russia. 6 million now live abroad as refugees, of whom over 1 million are children. Ukraine is left with the lowest birth rate in the world, lower than was recorded by any nation during either world war. For Ukrainians, the falling birth rate is not a side issue but is fundamental to the battle now being fought for the survival of the nation. This is why many private fertility clinics started to offer free sperm freezing and storage, and even IVF, to soldiers and their partners as soon as the full-scale war began, before the government decided to pay for this service. Alexander Yusko, chief of the Ukrainian Association of Reproductive Medicine, tells me, "Some Ukrainians are raising money for drones, some are buying cars for brigades. We are preserving the gene pool of the nation." By August last year, some 3,000 and half sperm and egg samples have been frozen and 300 IVF procedures conducted, at no expense to the soldiers. Demand has surged. Screening and freezing sperm usually cost about £170. Egg extraction and freezing is £1,000, while IVF starts at £2,000. The actual storage cost, which is enough to be met by the government, is the cheapest part. This Dr. Yusko says, is the problem. No one reimburses this screening and IVF costs for our clinics. There is no support from the state. Money tends to run out, even from private donors, he says. Ukraine's funds are so short that the subsidy scheme can start immediately. Dr. Stefan Chmiel's clinics in Ternopil and Lviv were the first to offer free cryoconservation and IVF for the military. They now have 550 sperm samples and have completed 275 IVFs, some with the help of an American patron. They have reserved generators to ensure a power supply in case Russian missiles take out the grid. Dr. Chmiel believes that cryoconservation should be not voluntary but obligatory, with every enlisted soldier freezing their gametes before going to war. He says this will help preserve the bloodlines that are threatened by war. Wounds which can render a soldier infertile make up to 10% of all injuries on the front line. Stress and hypothermia also take a toll. Recently, an officer and his wife came to see Dr. Chmiel. The soldier had fertility issues. It's no surprise why. Just imagine, it's a cold night and pouring rain, Russians are shooting and he is lying on the ground in a puddle because it is impossible to even raise his head. Of course he got severe hypothermia. When Russia invaded, Chmiel's colleagues saw a sharp increase in miscarriages, especially early stage. Women are increasingly likely to suffer pregnancy-induced diabetes and other complications. There are air raid sirens, bombing, mothers are rushed from the peritoneal center to the basement with their children, says Yusko. How can a pregnant woman survive it? War is not the only reason Ukrainians aren't having kids. Many can't afford to. Mothers are paid £700 for every birth, more than twice the average monthly salary. But this figure has been the same for 10 years, so inflation has cut its value by 2/3. There is some talk of raising it. Women who want to have children despite the war are heroes, Yusko says. They deserve nothing but praise and full support. As Ukraine's budget deficit is expected to reach £34 billion by the end of the year, the obvious step is to try and to find sponsors, to find the sperm freezing program, to see if this is a cause that might attract international support. And if there are people out there willing to help soldiers who are not just willing to fight and die for Ukraine, but also to provide new life.
That was Svetlana Monets. Next, Candida Crew.
On a trip to Italy via Paris last month, my travelling companion and I went to the Gare de Lyon at Sparrows to catch a train to Rome. We badly wanted coffee. I came to coffee late in life and am infantile and uncool in my love of frothy buckets of what is effectively a hot coffee milkshake. It's almost all about the milk, preferably whole and organic, but at the very least, fresh. So it was that Starbucks, which uses conventional milk in the UK, twinkling and open in the middle of the freezing station, made the heart lift. I took one sip and nearly spat it out. That inimitable taste and stench of UHT, or ultra-high temperature processed milk, made me heave. Coffee snobs who complain about disgusting coffee may be blaming the wrong element of their flat white. Pasteurised milk, which has an official shelf life of 4 to 6 days, but in reality lasts several days longer, is heated to no more than 70 degrees centigrade. This kills off bacteria to the extent that it prevents people getting stomach bugs. But the 135 degrees centigrade demanded of UHT desecrates every bug, several enzymes, and a few vitamins besides. This means UHT milk doesn't have to be refrigerated, and an unopened carton will last till your dotage. Okay, 9 months, but it also wipes out the whole joy of milk's original incarnation and transforms it, and in turn your coffee, into something monstrous. I have no beef with the Starbucks bean, but that morning the milk threw me straight back to my childhood holidays in France. I recognised then that the French did everything better than we did, except for two things. Loos, those urine-drenched Yeti footprints with a hole in between them over which you had to squat, and milk. They may have mastered mousseline de grenouille and mocked our spotted dick, but even devoted francophiles like me knew that their milk was rat's piss. Theories are that the bastardization of the taste might be caused by Maillard browning, the chemical reaction normally associated with turning food brown. This works wonders with seared steaks, biscuits, bread, peanuts, whiskey, and French fries and coffee beans, indeed. But the complex interplay caused by high heat between amino acids and the reduction of sugars, which creates the compounds that make some things delicious, is, in my snooty opinion, ruinous when it comes to milk. The ultra-zapping is a more advanced form of its gentler predecessor, pasteurization, which was invented in Lille by Louis Pasteur in the 1880s. So UHT was indirectly invented by the French, though it was not widely available until after the aseptic containers in which it must be stored and which made Tetra Pak immortal were invented. Even so, what on earth induces the French, and indeed so many other European countries, to put up with such pap and not start another revolution? French loos have improved, but French milk manifestly has not. Odd, considering that France has the biggest dairy industry in Europe after Germany, that their landscape and weather are conducive to dairy production, and that the French are the world's leading consumers of dairy products per capita. Dairy Global states that France produced 1,794 billion litres of cow's milk last August alone, presumably in its raw form, every bit as delicious as our own. It is the only country on the planet boasting 1,200 different types of cheese, butter and cream, often from raw, unpasteurised milk, since pasteurised doesn't work for lots of cheeses. France has about 60,000 dairy farms and many of its products display a recognised quality label. But its actual milk, in its ubiquitously ultra-treated form, deserves no such accolades. Granted, in French supermarkets you can lay your hands on the odd bottle of fresh milk these days, but their default milk remains UHT. I asked Jane Scotter, the distinguished owner of Fern Vero, a biodynamic farm in Herefordshire and head market gardener at Heckfield Park Farm near Basingstoke. She was partner for 16 years at Neil's Yard Dairy. The French don't eat breakfast, she says. I think maybe because they drink a lot, so might be hungover. They have black coffee. They don't drink milk or have porridge and cereal like we do. It's all about a big lunch. The French are obsessed with their health, but don't value normal milk enough. They save it for their cheese. As for British milk, she says, in British supermarkets, it can be poor quality, but it's still better than UHT. My personal theory is that people who are lactose intolerant are less allergic to the milk itself than to the poor quality of so much of it. Milk isn't dangerous, but it is volatile. Unless there's some crisis, there's no chance we'll take up UHT wholeheartedly in this country. Scotter believes sales of quality milk are on the rise. Raw, unpasteurised milk, though still niche, has become a thing among the well-being crowd. The global organic milk industry is set to be worth $32.8 billion in 2032, up from $23.2 billion in 2022, according to Future Market Insights. Meanwhile, in France, the market share last year for Frankenstein milk, as opposed to even bog-standard pasteurised fresh milk, stood at 95%, according to the Centre National Interprofessionnel de l'Économie Laitière. Fresh milk, organic or not, is available, but the French persist with their baffling preference, and they are by no means the only ones. Fresh milk accounts for only 33% of total liquid milk sales in Italy and a derisory 2% in Spain. To give this lot their due, UHT is practical, economically sensible and increasingly necessary as a means of feeding the world safely, especially in rural and remote regions, because it doesn't require refrigeration during transportation or at home until after it's been opened. and by God the stuff lasts. The execrable taste does, however, remain a sticking point for populations in some hot countries, most notably the sensible and discerning Greeks who tend to drink more fresh milk. It may seem logical that colder nations choose fresh milk because they have that luxury. Very few people buy UHT milk in Sweden or Denmark, and while it's available in Finnish supermarkets, it's not something people regularly consume. It is somewhat surprising that UHT never caught on in the USA. The world's leading UHT processor, Parmalat, tried to introduce it to the US market in 1993 and it effectively tanked, which is odd considering that Americans are hardly notable for eschewing ultra-processed food. But that's to underestimate the closeness of their relationship with their TARDIS-sized fridges and their ingrained habit of drinking cold, fresh milk, as Scotter observes, because they think it makes them grow. They are wary of milk that can live in a cupboard. The brains wishing to peddle UHT keep trying to wean us onto it. They began selling it in normal-looking milk packaging and put it in the chiller aisles. It still couldn't disguise what they call the high-cooked, but what I would call the synthetic sulphur flavour. They fiddled with it a bit and tried several methods, such as adding a compound to the milk before furnacing it, to minimise the demonic taste and smell. And I suppose, just as a child comes to like broccoli in the end, market forces and technical tweaks have encouraged people to become accustomed to UHT's convenience and in turn desensitized to its nastiness. So, to travel by train to and from Italy, ordering coffee along the way in France and Switzerland, is to play a game of latte roulette. Geneva's Starbucks, fresh milk. Basel Station cafes, all UHT, and incomprehensionate requests for lait frais. Oui, c'est frais! The hell it was. Thankfully, fresh milk is still to be found in cafes in Rome and Milan, less so in Bari. My European jaunt was in every respect bliss, except for the milk. There is a lot wrong with Britain, but I will say this. We still win gold for our gold top.
That was Canada Crew. And finally, Ascender Max Tone Graham.
Always make your redundancy announcement when the people at the receiving end of it are on a high. This seems to be the favoured method of today's managing executives, who perhaps imagine that adrenaline will somehow anaesthetise the blow of getting sacked. For the Cambridge Student Choir, St John's Voices, the news of its imminent disbanding and the redundancy of its director, Graham Walker, came just 2 minutes after the light was switched off at the end of a 3-day recording session of Russian choral masterpieces last week. In a 2-paragraph round-robin email to the choir that evening, the master of St John's College, Heather Hancock, explained that in the light of findings by an ad hoc committee, plus a report on the contribution of the chapel to the wider life of the college, the council has decided to adopt a broader approach to the provision of co-curricular opportunities in music for our students, including in different genres, and that, as a consequence, the college's funding would be redirected and St John's Voices will be disbanded at the end of Easter term 2024. This news was greeted with an outpouring of dismay and fury, not only by choir members, but also by hundreds of supporters across the country who are getting wearily used to signing petitions and writing letters in an effort to save the nation's musical institutions. These signatories, Simon Rattle and Rowan Williams are among them, can't bear to see the diminishment or disbandment of something specific and excellent that does exist in favour of something unspecific and well-meaning that does not exist. The brutal disbandment of yet another choir may seem a minor matter in the scheme of recent arts world debacles, but it's symptomatic of the casual drop bombshell and retreat behind your comms team methods of today's managerial class, who can't bear to keep the institutions as they find them, but feel an urge to leave their mark, often woefully ignorant of exactly what it is that they are destroying. The St John's decision was, rather sinisterly, made during a decanal interregnum. The new dean, Victoria Johnson, who starts next term, is extremely musical, and I'm told by people who know her that she would not have favoured such a decision. I rang the college's communications department at once and asked if I could speak to the master. They responded, "We aren't in a position to comment this week." When I pressed them, they said, "Unfortunately, the timeline for being in a position to comment is not flexible. The next day, under pressure, the college did issue a statement explaining in more detail what it intends to do. The new initiatives include masterclasses in songwriting, a scheme to provide music lessons for any St John student, enabling new ensembles and community music making, extending the musician-in-residence scheme to include jazz and pop, new opportunities for non-audition singing, innovative interdisciplinary projects and outreach and engagement programmes. All of which may sound worthy, especially in the current climate in which Oxford colleges are keen to make themselves attractive and approachable to state-educated pupils who may not have been fortunate enough to have the same standards of choral and musical training as their privately educated peers. But can't all these well-intentioned initiatives happen alongside the continued existence of St John's Voices? Does egalitarianism have to be promoted at the expense of up-and-running excellence? And does St John's Voices cost so much to run that it needs to be disbanded to make way for these new schemes? The choir's only paid member is the director, who I can't imagine is paid so very much for his this one-day-a-week job. St John's is the second wealthiest Cambridge college, with an endowment of more than £619 million. St John's Voices is a mixed choir, singing choral evensong to an extremely high standard. It's the only choir at the college where sopranos have a chance to sing in their own chapel choir. Its world-renowned 6 days-a-week main choir has child choristers singing top line. In her email to the choir, the master said she wanted to keep the chapel free on Mondays to enable other uses of the space and free time for the dean and chaplain to progress student programmes for civic engagement and for understanding faith. Well, if they must. But the chapel is free and empty for many other hours, the choir only using it for 2 hours in the early evening. Hancock was appointed master in 2020, having been a senior civil servant, private secretary to 3 home secretaries, and then a managing partner at Deloitte. She was an undergraduate at St John's in the 1980s, graduating with a first in land economy. With her husband Mark, she owns a grouse moor in Yorkshire. You can hear a bright, feminist-sounding voice on her new St John's College podcast called Souviens, inspired by the college's Tudor founder, Lady Margaret Beaufort. She interviews high-achieving female alumni of the college, and both of them gush about how wonderful it was to be at St John's as a woman. Well, it isn't quite so wonderful now if you happen to be a woman who loves singing and longs to do so in your own college chapel. I'm told that Hancock has never attended any services, concerts, events or rehearsals with St John's Voices, so she has no personal experience of how excellent they are, and has shown little interest in informing herself about what they do. As one St John's Voices singer said to me, no one should be naive enough about their responsibilities to take on the burden of running a college without understanding how delicate, fragile and vulnerable to managerial abuse it will prove to be, and that destroyed institutions and reputations can take decades to recover.
And that's everything for this week. But if you enjoyed those pieces, why not pick up a copy of our special Easter edition? I'm Oscar Edmondson, and I hope you join us again next week.